Tales through time.
Thank you for joining us for episode 2 of Tales Through Time. I'm Troy Newman.
And I'm Keegan Woodwick.
If you missed our first episode, let me quickly go over how we structure these. Whoever is presenting the personal life story of someone that day will give an anecdote from their own life that will help transition into that person's story. My father was 18 when I was born. He was around 20 when my sister was born, and shortly after, he essentially left our lives, had very little to do with us from that point on. However, we did not end up going our entire lives without a father figure, and that is where today's subject, Charles Sullivan, better known to us as Chuck, comes in.
Well, I grew up in my grandparents' house, and when I turned 8, I got shipped off to a foster family because my mother didn't like the fact that I thought she was my sister, because I thought my grandmother was my mother. 8 years old, I had no idea.
He grew up in the Chicago area, and kind of like you heard, he grew up living with both of his grandparents and his mother. He was around them for so long that when he was younger, he assumed his grandfather and grandmother were his parents.
That was very interesting to hear because, you know, when I was that age, when I was 4 or 5, I didn't know how to spell my name. So I would always guess, like, is it A-N or E-N at the end? Hearing that he didn't know who his mother was is interesting to me.
My mother was very young when I was born, so I spent a lot of time with my own grandparents as well, but I don't have any memory of ever believing they were my parents, and I've never been told any stories where I had that assumption either.
Yeah, I do find a little similarity between the two for his story, kind of growing up in mine, as I spent a lot of time with my grandparents as well, who I'd even consider kind of like my second parents, if you will.
Yeah.
So like I could understand a little bit for that confusion, especially when you're younger.
To me, what's crazy about this first answer is you're young. These kinds of mistakes, in my opinion, should be forgiven. But his mother sent him off to a foster family.
Yeah, which I find maybe it's a little much, some might say, to do that.
So at 8 years old, Chuck would be sent to this foster family, and he would end up living with this older couple for the next 5 years of his life before he was sent back to Chicago.
Oh, they're good old people. I mean, at the time I was with them, they were like in their 70s, mid to late 70s. They're basically retired and go on a lot of camping trips and stuff like that. It's just that I was too rambunctious. They already had a couple of foster kids and they figured they were getting too old for it. They had me from the time I was about 8 years old till about 13, just before I turned 13, at which time I got put into a group home on the south side of Chicago. I was the only white kid there. And I also went to an all-black school. I was the only white kid there.
What were you thinking at the time when you were 8 years old and you were being shipped off?
Well, let me put it this way. When I got finally got put in the group home, they made me see a therapist because I was in a group home. I had to see a therapist. Well, the therapist and everybody in the all the management in the group home told me the reason I was there is because nobody wanted me. I was worthless. Nobody wanted anything to do with me.
This is a therapist telling
you. Yes, a therapist. So that made me feel good.
It's hard to hear that a licensed therapist, or at least we're assuming that they're licensed, is telling a child that they're worthless and essentially that's why they're in the group home, because no one wants them. When you're at that age and going through that, like, that's, I mean, you can't really comprehend. Like, you just don't have the faculties to really understand.
Looking back on the interview, I'm curious if the faculty at the group home were essentially kind of going through motions, if this is something that they just kind of told all of the kids that were at the group home, which doesn't make it any better.
No.
If they're telling every kid that they're there because they're not wanted, that's not a great place to be.
I want to know, because obviously things were different that many years ago, how things ran, what were the requirements to be a therapist? Because, I mean, psychology has come a long way. I mean, one of my degrees is biopsych. Nowhere in our class does it ever tell us to tell children that they're worthless. So
I wouldn't imagine it would.
Nope.
As you heard in that answer a little bit, He grew up in urban Chicago, has a lot of black communities. The group home he ended up living at, he was the only white kid there. And when he ended up starting to go to high school, again, he was the only white kid there, which posed problems.
Did you act out while you were in the group home at all?
Act out? Oh, yeah. I had fights every day at school. And since I was pretty much the only white kid in the group home, everybody was afraid of me, even the 18-year-old black kids. Yes, I got angry a lot.
Was it like that before you moved off, before you were sent to a foster family?
No. That pretty much changed my life.
I feel like any situation we find ourselves in where we can easily be singled out can often prove to be difficult. He was easily singled out, which resulted him in getting into a lot of fights. That, in combination with the anger issues he had from being sent off from his family.
You know, when you are, regardless of orientation, skin color, when you are that kind of minority in a situation, it can be quite tough. In this situation, it's unfortunate that it led a little bit more towards the physical violence, towards everything. One thing that has been a consistent theme all throughout his, you know, development is that he's been having to bounce around. He's had a very unstable upbringing, not knowing who his mother was, you know, getting confused in a foster home for 5 years and in a group home where he's, you know, being told he's worthless, and then having to go to high school where he is the unique individual and having to kind of defend himself. It just leads to a lot of instability.
So at that point in our conversation, I was curious what it was like for him, both in the foster home and in high school. And this was one of the examples he gave me.
In 1970, I was a butch-haired kid, butch, crew-cut, little white, skinny white boy. I ended up going to a free concert in Grant Park in Chicago, which turned into a riot because the band that was supposed to show up for the free concert didn't show. People were turning over cop cars and everything. So I ended up walking 30 blocks through an all-black neighborhood in the late afternoon to get back to the group home. And that was a band called Sly and the Family Stone.
How did that walk home go?
Oh, I was scared shitless. But everybody, the counselors and stuff that were in the group home, you couldn't find them. You figure 70,000 people in that park, and everybody went different directions. I knew basically stay along the river, the lake, and I'll get home.
So you guys went to this free concert like as a group? The group home did?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then the counselors just...
Everybody. Yeah. Once the riot broke out, everybody just went all different directions. So I got to walk past Comiskey Park and numerous other areas down there until I got back to the group home. Little skinny little white boy.
How old were you at that time?
I was 13.
What was the day-to-day life like in the group home?
For a white kid, it's kind of weird, especially when he's got a butch cut. It wasn't bad. It's just that I was annoyed because of what and pissed off because of what they were telling me why I was there. You know, that will tend to mess with anybody's mind. And you end up getting severely troubled because of stuff like that. I learned to like chitlins, pig ears, pigtails, pig's feet, because that's what they ate.
What was school like during those years?
Well, I'd go to school. I'd just make passing grades, just enough to graduate. And I'd get into fights every day after school because I was the only white kid and everybody wanted to kick my butt. And by the time I graduated out of grade school, I had a lot of friends.
I can't believe, I mean, I guess this group home, par for the course, you know, leaving the kids out in the middle of a riot.
The faculty just abandoned the children that they brought there, which, like you said, kind of seems par for the course, considering that same faculty was also telling kids that they weren't wanted.
I think regardless, you know, of wherever you are, this is not an ideal situation to be in, to not have that family support, that group support that you need to make it through. And especially because, again, he's having to essentially fend for himself, being left in the middle of a riot, you know.
that really gets me. Just the complete abandonment of the kids that are supposed to be in their care. Just like, nope, you're on your own. Obviously, up until this point, his life has been pretty difficult. However, there were a couple of bright points where, particularly with these fights in school, where he'd said the kids that he would get into fights with, those same kids would end up being very good friends of his.
I ended up making a lot of Puerto Rican friends and Cuban friends and Hispanics, and they ended up going into street gangs.
What were they like before that?
They were okay. They were fine. They weren't really overly violent or anything, except towards me.
At least at first.
Yeah. But see, back in those days, when you got into a fight, they didn't whip out a gun and shoot you. It was a fist fight. Nothing else, just a fist fight. And, well, like I said, I had a lot of friends by the time I got out.
It's very much like a male testosterone way of making friends, you know?
In general, I think most people, if they're throwing down, you know, throwing hands, probably aren't going to be friends. But like you said, it was a different time and a lot of conflict was probably solved with that or any sort of issues. And it says that he made a lot of, you know, good friends from that. So, I mean, which is good. Everything so far has been a little tumultuous.
His story up until this point has been kind of, I don't want to say both good and bad, because a lot of the stuff that he had gone through in his early life is not stuff that I would want to go through, but there were still at least some bright points for him. He at least was able to make friends along the way that from time to time would be able to help him out. Many of those friends he met in grade school, but his time in school came to an early end.
I had 147 days of truancy in high school. And they sent me to a disciplinary school called Montefiore on 13th and Ashland. And they had an armed guard on the bus, cages on the windows, and I was the only white kid there too. And because I was white and I had a crew cut, they thought I was in a white gang, all the black kids there. I ended up getting along with them, but it took a long time for them to believe that I was not in a white gang. You know, because down there, it's like, you can go three different blocks and you got two different gangs, you know, at that time. But after spending a year in that school, I came back and got on the honor roll. I went from an F average to a B plus A average. And then I dropped out of high school.
Why'd you drop out?
I dropped out because, see, they had a teacher come into the group home and teach.
Chuck says that teacher would end up hitting on a lot of the students. He would call her out for those actions, and that would result in him getting kicked out of class. Because of that, Chuck ended up running away.
So the group home just keeps getting worse and worse.
Yes.
But I guess it is nice to see that there is a positive side. Unfortunately, he had to go to the disciplinary school, but he did come back and get good grades, and which is difficult to do, especially for, you know, when you're that age, like think back to, you know, your time in high school is impressive. I am no shining beacon of light when it comes to going to school. I also got a truancy letter during my junior year of high school.
Nice.
So I can sympathize with him there not wanting to go. But yeah, you know, it's good that he's kind of turning it around at this point. It sounds like it, at least so far.
To me, what's really interesting about that part of his life is that 100 and some days of truancy, he would end up going to this disciplinary school. He would apparently do well enough to go back to school and go from an F average to a B plus A average, and yet he still dropped out.
Which is unfortunate, and again, who's ever running this group home hopefully was investigated.
He would go on to drop out of school, and this would be the start of his very short time in the U.S. Navy.
I passed everything. The obstacle courses were awesome. Had fun. And I was a very athletic kid. I mean, in January, we're out playing football in t-shirts and shorts. Come on. Graduation was cool, you know. But all the things that followed weren't. And it wasn't the Navy's fault. It was mine.
Why did you initially go into the Navy?
Because I couldn't find a job. I joined in November of 74. They tried to get me in when I was 17 in October of 74. Well, I couldn't get the approval from the state to get in October. So I was able to get it in November. And I found out that the ones that got sworn in at Soldiers Field on October 10th, 1974, They were the last batch of people sent over to Vietnam.
So you missed
I missed it final deployment. By 1 month, which didn't bother me really. Because I thought, I mean, according to the news and everything else, they were done with the war since like July, you know. But no, they're still sending people over there in October. Mm-hmm. That was the last batch. So I got lucky with that deal. But I joined because I needed a job. I thought I could do really good. I mean, I went in, I qualified for my Class A school as a signalman, and I was in the upper part of my class. I graduated.
He had some big hopes for the Navy. In particular, when you join active duty military, you can stay in for 20 or 25 years and retire. After all of the tumultuous issues that he had gone through with his family, with the foster family, with the group home, with high school, and he was hoping to kind of with the disciplinary school where he was able to turn over a new leaf there, he was really hoping to be able to turn over another new leaf here.
As we've, you know, already covered, his life has been incredibly unstable at this point. I personally haven't been through in the military. I'm assuming it's very structured. A lot of routines, kind of know what you're expecting. You've gone through that, right?
I joined the Army when I was 17. It was very different from what I was used to up until that point. Kind of like you said, it was very structured, very routine. At least basic and AIT were very much regulated, I guess is a good way to put it. You have to be here at a specific time doing this specific thing for this specific amount of time. When you get out of training, it's not as structured. It's still the military. There's still a lot of structure there, but it's a different kind of structure, I guess I would say.
One thing I noticed is he went to that disciplinary school, came back and started doing really well. And then he mentioned that he was excelling in some sort of military exams. So it sounds like for him, like, again, he's thriving in a structured environment.
It sounds to me like structure is what helped him excel. When he was in a group home, when all they were doing was essentially telling him that that no one wanted him, and when the teachers were themselves causing issues, he would have issues as well. But in these structured environments, kind of like you mentioned, the disciplinary school and basic training for the Navy, he did exceedingly well. As I said earlier, before we heard from Chuck about his time in the Navy, it was a rather short amount of time that he would spend in the military, though. And part of that reason is because of a young woman that he met during his time in high school, Pam. She would go on to be the mother of Chuck's first three kids, but as he will tell you, she was problematic.
She kept putting this thought in my head that I shouldn't be going, we're doing what my commanding officer said. I should be doing what I want. And being an idiot, I believed her.
Chuck says it was partly because of that goading that he would end up going AWOL, or absent without leave.
One time I went over the hill, got a job at Big Boy Restaurant for about a week until they found out I was AWOL. So then I ended up spending about 6 months in the brig.
What were those 6 months like?
Boring. Very boring. I wake up in the morning, eat slop, and get sent out into a mountain of sand filling hurricane sandbags. And that's all I did for that period of time. And then an attorney, a Navy attorney, said that what he could do for me is he can get me out of the Navy with a general discharge, unsuitable for military life. And that's what he pursued. So I took that.
For anyone who has not been in the military or does not know anyone that has been in the military, you cannot just leave. As Chuck mentioned, he ended up getting caught, and he would spend 6 months in the brig, which is the Navy equivalent of a jail.
I do like that his job, after going AWOL, was working at, what, the Big Boy Restaurant?
Yeah, as he would put it.
Yeah. What we've heard so far is that he hasn't really had any close connections. Like, he's made friends after getting into fights with them. And so this is a first person from what, you know, what it sounds like that he's mentioned thus far that he's connected. I mean, he's married to this person, or at least in a relationship.
If you're lacking those kinds of relationships, it might be understandable that you would do whatever you can to keep those kinds of people in your life, even if that means going against a commanding officer in the military exactly. to do as your wife is asking you to do. Unfortunately for Chuck, it would not turn out well.
Spend 6 months tossing hurricane sandbags in Connecticut.
Filling hurricane sandbags. Oh, filling them. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's definitely worse things he could have been doing while in the brig, but 6 months straight of filling hurricane sandbags is not ideal.
No. You know, it's nice as a civilian, you can just give a 2 weeks notice. Some you don't even need to give a notice at times to quit your job. But yeah, when you're in the military, you're locked in.
That was just one example of who Pam was, and Chuck had plenty more.
I got a job. She lost me a job. I got another job. She lost me that one.
Seeing a pattern.
I ended up working for Horizon Management's the name of the group. And I was doing really good with them. I was their maintenance supervisor for 3 apartment complexes. And there was a company cookout. And then my dear wife, of course, couldn't come sober. She got there, and then all she talked about with my boss is how I was beating her all the time. And I lost my job. Yeah.
Do you have any idea why she would do that?
That's her. And the thing is, I was warned about her before we even got together. And I didn't want to believe it because I lived an angry life. I told him to kiss off. And I think I ended up getting with her just to piss them off. You know, and essentially, it took me out. You know? But then again, my life wouldn't be where it's at right now if I wouldn't have.
Mm-hmm. How long were you two together?
18 years.
I'm a loss for words that was said at his work event to his boss.
Chuck was adamant that he had never hit her. He's never abused any woman that he's been with. He has mentioned that he has used physical discipline on his children before, but that was, in his words, that was because Pam urged him to do it, because Pam told him he needed to. So again, from Chuck's perspective, this was someone that was forcing bad habits not only on him, but on his children as well. So this was the woman who convinced Chuck to ignore his commanding officers in the Navy, which would end up getting him to go AWOL and eventually discharged. From there, he would move back to the Chicago area while he was still with Pam. From there, Chuck would go through some rather desperate times.
I stayed down in Hyde Park for a while and ended up without a job. Ended up siphoning gas out of people's gas tanks to keep my car running. And there was a little black kid that was in the group home, that went into the group home since I was out of it. And he didn't like the fact that I was hanging out with everybody else in the neighborhood. And he went and got his big buddies in the gang to come after me. And what happened is I was siphoning gas one night, middle of the night. And all of a sudden I heard a click behind my head. That was really scary. I turned around into a barrel of a .38. And I look up, and it was one of my friends. And we started shooting the bull, and he told that little black kid, get out of here. It's a friend of mine. So we hung out together for a while. But that was about the scariest time I ever had. You know, it made life real interesting.
Can you imagine what it was like to have a gun cocked at the back of your head?
I mean, I can't. I mean, I'm a big horror aficionado, but you know, that's where it stays in the movies, not in real life. So if that was me in this situation, I would be like, here's my money, here's my wallet, my phone, just, you know. But yeah, no, thank goodness it was someone he knew.
Up until this point, a lot of the things that Chuck had been through kind of stemmed with that incident from when he was 8 years old, when his mother decided to send him away. So I asked Chuck if his relationship with his mother, what it was like at that point, and if it had even survived him being sent away.
She was in my life periodically since I was put in the group home. I got to see her and other family members maybe once every 3 or 4 months. For about an hour in a supervised visit. The way they made it sound in the group home was she didn't see me is because she didn't want anything to do with me. Otherwise, she could have seen me more. The truth is, they didn't want to deal with my having visitations more often than that. They were getting money from the state for having me in that group home, and they were happy with what they were doing.
Did your mother ever try taking you out of the group home?
No. Not that I'm aware of. And the reason I got put in the group home is because of her girlfriend. Years ago, where her girlfriend told her that my grandparents were screwing me over and they're going to end up killing me or causing me to be deranged. And what it was my mother was jealous because I thought she was my sister.
What do you remember about your grandparents?
Oh, my grandfather, great white hunter, big handlebar mustache. He'd go out, take off to Canada for months at a time hunting, come back with moose and bears and all kinds of other stuff, carcasses. And my grandmother, she was kind of angry all the time because her and my grandfather didn't really get along too well. And she'd drink about 20 pots of coffee a day. And smoke about 2 or 3 packs a day of cigarettes, you know. But at that point, I felt like they loved me. Even though I found out later, my grandfather, he'd take me hunting with him out to the shooting range. He was shooting the bull with some of the other hunters, saying he'd shoot down a bird and have me go get it. And he said that so many times he wanted to pull out that gun and put me out because he didn't want nothing to do with kids.
Where'd you learn that from?
I learned that from my mother years later, after my grandfather died.
Given what your mother had done up to you up until that point, what made you believe her about your grandfather?
Because there was a couple of times where I had thought about it when I was out with my grandfather, he'd send me out to the to pick up the birds he shot down, like a retriever, you know. And one time he shot a hawk. When that thing clamped onto my wrist with its claws, that scared me. And he just laughed at me and thought it was so funny. It's just his attitude. Years later, I started picking up on it, saying, you know, it doesn't sound off about him.
Do you feel like your relationship with your mother ever recovered after what she had done to you during your childhood?
It recovered to an extent. There's only so far I can go, as it is now. She expects me to be there and call her every week. I might call her once every 2 or 3 or 4 months. Because I'm not a family-orientated person anymore. I never really was, but I keep telling her, hey, Ma, I grew up on the streets. I don't have a family, you know?
I really like that you did follow up, because that was my question as he was telling about the story. You know, why would he choose to believe his mom? Because that's quite a accusation, quite a thing to say, especially to your child. Telling him that your grandfather wanted to essentially put you down while he took you hunting.
Especially because, as Chuck said, in his early years, he thought his grandparents loved him.
And this kind of arcs back to our first interview, our first podcast, where we talked about Tom coming back to his family and, you know, what he thought in the family bonds that he had when he was younger versus, you know, when he encountered his father later on.
Having to reconcile with who these people actually are compared to who you believed they were when you were a child.
Exactly. It was hard to hear about his mom only coming to see him like an hour every 3 months and then the family leaving him, even though they could have potentially taken him out. I guess, you know, we don't know.
We talked about all the issues that Chuck would have with family, the relationship he would end up getting into with Pam. Given all the struggles he'd have up until now, Chuck decided it was time for a fresh start. And this was when he moved to Wisconsin.
Then in 94, I ended up moving up to Wisconsin. Or 92, I ended up moving up to Wisconsin. And that's where I met Kathy. We started seeing each other. She had a really interesting way to look at things. She was fun to be around. And then, you know, we hung out more and more and more and got closer. And then we ended up moving in, or she moved in with me. And then a little while later, you and Star moved in. That lasted for roughly 19 years. I was with her longer than I was with Jason's mother.
It was shortly after Chuck moved to Wisconsin that he would end up meeting my mother. Chuck was the man that essentially raised me and my sister. Chuck was there for most of our childhood, and Chuck being there was something that really helped with me and my sister. Despite all of Chuck's issues, I really believe that the difficulties, the issues, the trauma that he had gone through helped him become a better person, which is what helped me become who I am today.
The sort of challenges that Chuck has faced in his life, the fact that like when he is kind of presented those challenges or in those structured environments, he blossoms. And not to mention that, like, he spoke fondly of these, the 19 years. There is nothing that he thus far has said, and to, you know, otherwise.
Despite everything, Chuck was able to kind of find that family structure that he had been missing for essentially all of his life up until that point. He was with my mother for 19 years. He would go on to call her a very important person in his life. It's just unfortunate that things did not work out between them. They would end up getting married, but only remain married for a couple of years, and they would go their separate ways. I feel like he still internalizes it as almost his fault, because he references himself as not a family-oriented person, probably because of all of that stuff that he had gone through in his childhood.
And again, it comes back to that he didn't have a model relationship on how to bond with family or with others. In his previous marriage, there were many challenges that he faced. I will say it's quite nice that you and him are able to kind of speak about this in a more objective manner and you know, look back on this time.
Before Chuck and my mother would end up getting divorced, before they would go their own ways, they would have a child of their own together, my little brother Christian.
I was in the operating room when he was born. We knew right down to the within a four-hour window when he was going to be born. So, yeah, it was great.
What were you thinking at that time? When he was born, the first time you held him in your arms.
Oh, it was great. I just, this is awesome. Because I had one other kid. I was in the room when he was born. He was born at home. And it wasn't the same because of the woman I was married to. Your mother, I loved her. You know, I'll always love her, you know. She was an important person in my life. So, I mean, when Christian was born, yeah, it was awesome.
It's nice hearing him talk positively about a situation after everything that we've heard so far. You can hear it in his voice that he's excited, you know, for Christian.
We touched on it a bit in the first episode, but I genuinely feel like companionship one way or another, whether that be romantic or friendship or otherwise, maybe even father-son kind of companionship, I feel like companionship for many people is something that we spend much of our lives looking for. And Chuck, even though he and my mother are separated now, even though he is still single, he has been able to find some of that companionship with Christian. Now in his 60s, Chuck still struggles financially, but that isn't stopping him from doing what he can to provide for his family and give them a better future.
I have no great hopes. I'd love to be able to retire from work. I'm 64 now. But at this point, I'll never be able to because the cost of living keeps going up and the pay doesn't. I mean, if I were to retire from work right now, I'd bring home about half of what I make. And I can't live like that. It's impossible, you know, because I take care of my kids and stuff. I mean, I take care of Jason. I take care of Christian. Christ, I spoil Christian. I don't know how many games he's got over here. You know, I mean, I've already got two or three games pre-ordered that are coming out in the next 6 months, you know. They paid $100 for, you know. But, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way.
I do like that when he talks about it, because it's important to him, kind of, you know, having these relationships. Like he said, he enjoys taking care of his kids, you know, Christian, Jason. And I mean, who can't relate to being that young and wanting to order games? And again, like, they just want their kids to be happy. And like, they want, you know, to leave a good impression that they're taken care of. And I think that's in his life, that's incredibly important that he is taking that away. And, you know, maybe it's because he's faced all these challenges throughout, you know, ever since he was a child, that he's making that concerted effort.
Chuck's life has seen some pretty dramatic down points, but there have been up points as well. Nowadays, Chuck looks forward to the time he gets to spend with his youngest son, Christian, and his second born, Jason, which I think are two relationships that are very important to him nowadays.
And I think, you know, what we can kind of gather from Chuck's story is that this person has been through, I know we've already said this multiple times, but again, he, you know, been through quite a lot, but he's maintained a positive outlook. You know, he is happy where he is right now. He's enjoying taking care of his kids, spending time with his youngest. And I think that's kind of like something that we could kind of really take away from his story is that when you're faced with adversity, with challenges, how do you come out at the other end?
As is quite obvious by now, Chuck has had a rather large impact on my own life. My father has been absent for most of it. Chuck was the man that kind of stepped in to help raise me. Even though he has referenced himself multiple times in this episode as not family-oriented, he did help raise me and my sister. I look back fondly on my time with Chuck. I do not see the same side of him that he sees. He is capable and is willing to give to others in his life, which is something that I hope that he holds on to. This story strongly ties into not only my own life, but my mother's life as well. We will get into her story in a future episode, which, for anyone who's also listened to our first episode, also ties into Tom and Bonnie's life. I hope anyone who's made it this far into our second episode is willing to continue with us as we explore the lives of various people, whether they be related to our own life or not.
And we just want to say thank you to those who are listening to our second episode. We appreciate you tuning in, and we look forward to bringing you more episodes. You can reach us on all three major social media networks, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We are Tales Through Time, TalesThruTime. We do have a Patreon that we're getting set up, so we'd love for people to support us. And that way we can continue to bring you episodes, interview people. You can subscribe there, but also with rewards if you want to put forward like a little shout out on our podcast for an episode. If you want to recommend yourself or anyone you know that would like to share their story, we'd be more than happy to take that. And of course, any feedback that we could do to improve. Recording in Viroqua
and Minneapolis.
I'm Keegan Wedwick.
And I'm Troy Newman. Thank you for joining us.